Welcome to Shetland with Laurie, a podcast dedicated to Shetland, the place and the people, with me, Laurie Goodland, a writer and tour guide based at 60 degrees north. The Shetland with Laurie podcast is for people who have visited Shetland, or who would like to visit, or for those who would just like to know a little bit more about life here. So welcome, I'm so glad you're here. Hello and welcome to today's podcast. On today's show I am chatting to Terry Malcolmson, who runs the business Terry Laura. She is a knitwear designer and teacher who is based here in Shetland. So on the show we chat about her work, her classes, her inspiration and the amazing benefits of wool. So let's get started and dive right in. Hi Terry and welcome to the Shetland with Laurie podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you Laurie for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So before we kind of get started and get into the nuts and bolts of what it is that you do, could you just kind of tell us who you are and a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, so I am Terry Malcolmson. I run my business Terry Laura. We produce Fair Isle knitwear as well as teach classes about Fair Isle and colour work, and I've just started doing a bit more work around the promoting wool side of things.
And I've always wanted to ask this, but where did the business name come from?
Yeah, so Terry Laura is my first name and middle name. All of my siblings in my family were all got middle names that come from a great-grandparent. So I had a great-grandmother called Laura. So my middle name is Laura, named after her. So I wanted to use that in my business name and also to keep things quite open-ended so that I could change my mind about what I wanted to do and I wasn't kind of stuck with whatever was in my name.
And you're a Shetlander born and bred, and you speak about your granny Laura. Is your kind of family history something that is important to you, and did they influence your knitwear? Were they knitters?
Yeah, so my family have been in Shetland for generations. On all sides of my family, we can trace back to about the 1600s and everybody has got a Shetland address, which is really amazing to see. I was expecting somebody to have been moved to Shetland at some point, but everybody seems to have been here and from all corners of Shetland too. So I like to kind of get as much information as I can about as many people as possible and be inspired from there. So it's a few people were knitters. I've got a lot of relatives who were also sewers and would do things with different kinds of fabric. And also being self-employed is really common in my family.
You kind of started out working or helping, I suppose, your other granny, Wilma.
Yeah, so she's my granny. She is the granny that lives closest to where I grew up as well. So we saw her a lot. She has had her knitwear studio for as long as I can remember, and it was always just so much fun to go there, and we would play shop there. We would see what she was making. We would be encouraged to play with the colours ourselves as well. So it was really a lot of fun and a good place to grow up. And it's really interesting to go back there now as a working perspective and probably being more productive as we maybe were when we were younger. I think we made more of a mess than help.
It's all part of the creative process, I'm sure.
You can call it that.
And we actually share a great-great granny, don't we?
Yeah, that's a side that's got all the sores as well. So maybe there's something in you too, Laurie. What are you going
to... There might be. I'm actually a terrible knitter, I have to say. I started knitting a Fair Isle jumper 6 or 7 years ago, and it's gradually made its way onto the loft now. So
your mum's got all the talent for that.
Yeah, my mum's a knitter too. And so I suppose you're quite young still. You've had a kind of number of different jobs. You actually trained as an audiologist. So can you kind of explain to us how it is that you came to be a self-employed knitwear designer and the kind of path that you took to get there?
Yeah, well, when I was growing up, I We lived on a croft, and as well as that, my dad had a garage which was right outside our house. He still has it. So we grew up with my dad working for himself. He would have employees there as well. So it was a really busy place to live. There was always people coming and going. And I said when I was at school that I would never own my own business. I thought it was just, you never switched off. It was always go. Every single day there was people. So I thought that it maybe just wasn't for me. But it wasn't until I started doing different kinds of work and I realized that I kind of wanted a different job for every day of the week. I really like the variety that comes with being self-employed. So since leaving school, I was 17 when I left school and I was 21 when I started my business full time. So it's not really a long time, but I have had a few jobs, starting from Saturday jobs, including I worked in Malcolmson's Bakery when it was still open, and also the shoe shop that's on the main street here in Shetland. So I really liked being in the busy parts. I liked working on the main street because there was always something going on. I liked to be in the middle of everything. So I did that when I was still at school. Those were my Saturday jobs. And then when I left school, I was still deciding what I wanted to do. So I spent the summer working in the Husick Visitor Centre. I don't know if you know that, Laurie.
I didn't know. No, I had no idea that you worked there. I absolutely love Husick Visitor Centre. And it's somewhere that I, when I do tours, I if I'm in the South Mainland, then we usually always go there. Fantastic selection of crafts and unbeatable cake too.
Yeah, exactly. So me and a few other girls about the same age, we ran the cafe. We would be baking in the morning and then we'd be serving up the lunch, and it was just so much fun to work there. You would see so many different people. We would have such a laugh amongst ourselves as well. That was a lot of fun. But at the time, the visitor centre did close at the end of the summer, so I did still need to make up my mind about what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So then I went on to work in the Bank of Scotland. I just wanted to, I wanted to kind of be a bit of a professional. I wanted something, that I was going to learn a lot as well. So I worked in the bank. I also thought I'd still be able to see a lot of people because, again, it was on the main street. After a while, then I felt like I wanted to be working more closely with people, and that's when I went into audiology. So I went to work in the hospital as just an assistant in the audiology department, and then within a few months they asked if I wanted to train up, just because I really liked working with the patients. So yeah. I did 2 years of a diploma. It was kind of like an apprenticeship style, so I would go away to Edinburgh and do a block at the university, and then I would come back and do mostly practical practice in the clinic. So that was a lot of fun. And then my situation at work kind of changed, and it was the perfect opportunity to try and start my business. I'd been growing this hobby, and I'd been showing people what I was making, and I was getting some really good feedback. Mm-hmm. So although I am still involved in the hospital and I go back and help out now and again when they need some extra help, I really took that opportunity to start my business and really just to give it a go.
And it was a real leap of faith, I suppose, for you. How did your family and people around you, how did they react to when you said that you were going to start your own business and you were going to fly solo?
I don't think they were, nobody was surprised, because I had been gradually growing what I was doing, and they could see as well the positive feedback I was getting. Yeah. And also the situation at work as well. Then they knew that I was going to have to make a change somewhere. Also, I was the only one in my household going to a 9-to-5 job. Everybody else was self-employed. So my dad, my mum, and my brother, they were all self-employed. So I was the odd one out going to a job like that.
Yeah, you kind of traditional 9-to-5.
Yeah, so I had a lot of support when I left that to start my own thing. There was lots of advice to be given, and I could base myself at my grandmother's workshop as well, which had a lot of people coming in, and I could kind of get used to the environment and help generate ideas about what I could do to kind of add to the industry, I suppose.
Yeah, and you've since moved on from being based at your granny's workshop, and you now have your own kind of workspace.
Yeah, so while all this was going on, we were in the middle of plans to build a house. So it was a really busy time. Yeah, so now we've been living here for over a year now, which is really good. And I've got all my machines and all my yarn and my stock here. So it's really nice to be based at home and working from home. But I still go to Cunningsborough to my granny's workshop about once a week, either to work on something with her or help her with something, or just to catch up on what everybody's up to as well.
And so could you kind of talk us through what it is that you do from the kind of initial generation of an idea in your head to producing a kind of finished garment, and how it is that you produce what you do?
Yeah, so I would say every project is really different for me. I definitely work best when there is a purpose behind what I'm doing. So if I'm making something for somebody, or a custom design that needs to fit a particular place, or I really like when people give me kind of a mood board and then I can turn it into something that they might have in mind. So I would start with some kind of inspiration, and if I don't have something straight away, then I would go and find something. My favorite thing really to do is base designs and colorways off of people. So I'm such an extroverted person, as you know.
Yeah.
I just love getting to know. Yeah, I love getting to know people. Actually, it's the working alone side of things that is my least favorite. I would plan, hopefully in the future, to have a team around me.
That was actually a question that just came to mind when we were speaking there, because you are such a people person, and we've spoken before that you're quite extroverted and you like people being around you and you like talking to people, and that, I suppose, was one of the things that sprung to mind, was how do you cope with being self-employed, and because it can be quite a solitary thing to do when you're working on your own for yourself and you've not got that team of people to bounce ideas off, or in an office where you can go in and chat to people. So I suppose, how do you cope with the isolation of being self-employed?
Yeah, well, it's true. I sometimes, if I have to be working from home in my house all week, I really have to find ways of breaking up my day, or I will just go crazy. I really don't like being by myself for really long stretches of time. So I am collaborating all the time. I always jump on the opportunity to do things like this with you, or to, I've just arranged to have catch-ups with people just to bounce ideas off of people. Yeah. That's maybe not so in it as much as I am. So I've done that with you. I've got other kind of creative friends as well that I'll meet up with just to have conversations with. And again, this designing things for people is a really big part of it as well. I do have a team that help me, but what they are helping me with the production side. So if I have a machine knitter and I have a finisher, and the work they do for me is their secondary job. So they have kind of their main jobs, and then this is just something extra for them.
Yeah.
So I'm really grateful for them to help me with that kinds of things, and they're so knowledgeable as well. So I can go to them for advice on that areas, and they'll be able to say maybe what they would do or their preferred way of doing it. And I find that's a really good way to do things too.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of collaboration. So working with my granny, or I always keep in touch with like my mom and my sisters and say, oh, what do you think of this? Yeah, I just speak to people all day.
Yeah. And so when you have the initial idea, and you start kind of working it together in your head, where do you go with it? How do you end up with a finished piece, a finished garment?
Yeah, so my favorite part of the whole process is color. So depending on the situation, if the whole purpose of the piece is to do with what the colors are, they don't really mind what shapes are involved or which motifs are involved, it's all about the color. Mm-hmm. Then I will probably start with color and make sure I get that right before I move on to how the colour is going to be used. So I would start to organise the colours I have in mind and finding any other colours to help the main colours shine out a bit more. So definitely I would start in that case with the main colours I need and then try and find context for them.
Yeah.
Which just takes practice, I would say. And looking at a lot of colourful things all day, which is always fun. And if it is more to do with this motif needs to be used, or it needs to be for this garment and it needs to work in this way, then I would start with that and I would save my favourite part till the end, which is the colour. Oh. So definitely depends project to project. But I really do like keeping people in mind and thinking about what they like, what they normally wear or have in their house, or what I think they've maybe not thought of yet that would suit them or would suit the space. So there's lots of different ways that I tackle things, and really every project is different.
Yeah. And so you say that you get your inspiration from people. Is there anywhere else that you find inspiration? Where do you get all the inspiration for all these fantastic designs? And how does it feel to see it coming together?
It's really amazing when it does come together, and I really like when it comes together in the way that you expected, but I also really like when there's something surprising for me about it as well. Because I am not a dyer in any way, I use colours that are already dyed and they've already been produced, and I need to find different ways of using them to make them kind of look different or to show them off or whatever I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
So watching colours interact with each other is really interesting to me. So I like to look at, you know, like paintings or photos, because we know that there's colours interacting with each other in there as well.
Yeah.
Definitely the landscape in Shetland. We have such a kind of privilege here that we're just surrounded by changing colours all the time.
Yeah. And this year, the heather in the hill has been an incredible colour. It flowers purple at this time of year. And even as somebody that's not visually creative, and I don't make anything, I can see how the landscape here is just so filled with all these different colours, and how nature seems to have a way of putting just the perfect palette together.
Oh, this summer, good job there's not been a lot of face-to-face events that people have been waiting for me for, because I have taken so many detours home just to go and see, I wonder what it's like on this side of that hill, or just to go and see, because it has been so striking this year, and it's just been amazing to, I've just gone on a drive and just followed it just to see if it ends, which it didn't this year. It was just amazing to see. Yeah, so the landscape is a big one for me. I also really like looking at interior design catalogues and things. So
okay.
Like curtains and couches and things like that. They're really good ways of just, I like to look at it and see, oh, how did they decide to choose that colour? Or I wonder what the process was until they got to here. And there's a lot of learning you can do, and you're never going to run out of colours, and there's always a new combination or something new to discover with them. So it's really endless.
You work with your colours, but it's also part of your teaching too. Could you just tell us a little bit about the kind of classes that you do and how people can get involved, perhaps people that are just starting out on their knitting journey, or those that are maybe a bit more experienced but need help? And what kind of classes is it that you offer people?
Yeah, so my absolute favourite one to teach is obviously the colour one. And I love that one because we don't knit in that session. We are just doing the getting your hands on colours, pairing them up and seeing how they kind of react with each other. So even if you're a complete beginner, you don't need to worry about your skills in knitting, because we're just playing in that class.
Yeah.
And I walk you through the steps of how to test out colours, how to, when you're in a yarn shop, how to start to choose the colours to take home, because we can't all buy every colour every time.
No, which can be quite overwhelming. I know as a non-knitter, when I have gone into, like, my granny might ask me if what colours I would like in a jumper for, like, one of my bairns or for myself, and I'll go into the wool shop and I'm just totally overwhelmed by choice.
Exactly. So I like to kind of help people take away that overwhelm. because it is, there's just so much to look at and it's difficult to know where to start as well. So we go through a few different techniques of how to pick out colours, how to test them a little bit in the shop before you take them home and get really into testing how they work out together. And starting to put together colourways for Fair Isle as well and making sure we've got the background and foreground and that your motifs are going to be able to be seen. So that's my favourite one to teach. I also have classes that I've been teaching regularly through this summer online, including that colour work one, but then also I have my crowns one, which is for people who are knitters, but they've maybe knitted a crown before. You don't even have to have knitted a crown before of a hat, but we speak about the design elements as well as the knitting. So we need to understand how the crown comes together in order to design what goes on in that space. So I speak about all of that. So again, you don't have a high skill in knitting as long as you can understand, or as long as you can look up the different decreases and things that we're speaking about.
Yeah.
Then that one, I like to keep things simple as well, because then there's more room to do the colour on top if your shapes are simple.
Yeah.
So most of them are quite simple and really just breaking things down to make it easier for you to make things your own, because that's really what I enjoy. I've got a similar class as well about mitts and gloves, where we speak about how they're made and how you can start designing your own style onto mitts and gloves. And then I also have one-on-one sessions available for if you're working on something really particular and you want to just spend an hour and a half speaking about it and going through any thing that's tripped you up or any struggles that you're having, then we will just dedicate an hour and a half to me and you speaking about that too.
And your online classes have been really popular during lockdown. We're recording this kind of as we're easing out of lockdown, but you've kind of had to change a lot of what you were planning to do this, and you went online and did these online classes, and they've been popular, haven't they?
Yeah, they've been so good. I've really enjoyed them. I really wasn't sure at the beginning. It's actually something I've been meaning to do for maybe a couple of years now.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't sure how it was going to work. And we were busy enough in the summer that it wasn't really, there was no push for it. But then lockdown kind of got me going to try it out. There was people asking for it. So I thought, oh, I'll give it a go. And it's been just amazing. Those have been my most popular classes. Most months I've done maybe 2 or 3 sessions of each. So it's been really good. And also being able to connect with people who maybe don't know about Shetland enough to have it on their bucket list yet.
Yeah.
Or want to just get a taste to see what the whole Fair Isle thing is about, or anything like that. People that I wouldn't maybe have spent time with before, because I maybe wouldn't have seen them in the summer, then I've been able to see them in the classes. And I've been so, it's such a good feeling when people come back. So maybe somebody would come for one of them and then they would book on all the rest as well. So that's such a compliment if they enjoyed that one and they've booked more. So yeah, it's been really encouraging to do, and having the time just to have conversations with groups of people that would never have been together otherwise as well, because we're people from all over the world all in the same session.
Yeah, and it's about bringing people together, and for lots of people they might not have the opportunity to come to Shetland and attend one of your classes in person, so I suppose it gives just a greater number of people a chance to kind of get involved and dig a bit deeper into the knitting heritage here and just learn from an expert.
Yeah, it's been really good, and it's really opened my eyes to a lot of possibilities. So it's definitely been a silver lining of the whole situation.
And do you think that you'll carry on these type of classes as well if you've got time once everything goes back to whatever normal might look like?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I have so enjoyed doing it. I'm really into the way of it now as well. So it's something I do look forward to. It'll be really good for winter when there's less people in Shetland. And as well, like you say, the people who maybe couldn't get to Shetland anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely they will be carrying on.
if I was to come to one of your classes, what are some kind of quick tips that you would share in a knitting class, if you're allowed to give that away?
Yeah, I'll give you a few. So I would say, and this is something that you can quickly do in the yarn shop too, is if you are choosing colours for Fair Isle, you want to make sure that when they are knitted in the same row, they're not going to fade into each other and the shapes aren't going to disappear. Mm-hmm. So something I tell people to do is to twist two strands together and see how clear that twist is. And if when you twist them, they kind of disappear into each other, then that's what they're going to do when they're knitted. Uh-huh. But if you can clearly see the definition of each colour, then you know it's going to be clear to see the difference when they're knitted as well. So that's a really quick one that can help people. One that I say, if you're overwhelmed in the yarn shop, just start twisting and you'll be able to kind of get your short list whittled down a lot faster.
Yeah, that's where I find problems.
So many choices.
That's a good tip.
Yeah. And you're just really looking for that contrast. That is the main thing in Fair Isle, is the contrast between your foreground and background.
Yeah. And I suppose that you say that that's one of the main things about Fair Isle, is just getting that contrast. But in terms of Fair Isle and Shetland knitwear in general, why is it that Shetland knitwear is kind of so world renowned?
I think
that's a big question.
It is a big question. I think that our location is a really big factor in this. So because we're in the middle of the sea, we've had, you know, boats coming and going from all different places. And Shetlanders are surprisingly well traveled too.
Yeah.
So I think that helped get the word around really quickly. It also meant that there was a lot of inspiration coming into Shetland. So you can see similarities in our kind of neighbouring Scandinavian countries too. You see a lot of kind of similar styles. So I think that is a big part of it. I also think that Shetland people are really quietly hard work. Yeah, if there's a job to do, then it gets done. So, yeah. And also there's a really, there's always been a real sense of community and a caring nature as well. So you can really help someone a lot by providing knitted garments. You know, you can keep them warm, you can keep them a little bit more safe at sea.
Yeah.
It's got time and effort and thought that's been put into it. And then you've got the design and how it looks as well. So I think there's just something quite heartwarming about being giving. So that kind of thing stick with people, I think.
Definitely.
Also, the practicalities of Fair Isle are huge. So a lot of what makes Fair Isle is to do with how it's comfortable to knit and how you can pick up your speed quite well in Fair Isle, just with the rules that we follow. So I think that's what kind of makes something long lasting, is how practical it is. And it is a really practical style to knit too. So
yeah, and I suppose through history we've seen, I mean, and most people will have seen the kind of iconic images of Shetland women with a basket of pizza on their back, and they're walking through the hill and they're knitting as they go. And I mean, Shetland women historically have just always been knitting, and they've always, it's just kind of like an integral part of life. I mean, less people knit today, but in the past everyone was knitting.
Yeah, and it's actually we're almost going back to there. There's a lot of people learning to knit now.
Yeah.
That haven't knitted since they were at school. And that's something as well that's special about Shetland, is that we did have knitting in school for a long time. So the interest is really growing again. And I think the more people who come to Shetland to kind of experience the knitting, as well as encouraging Shetlanders, like, yeah, we do have something really special here. And we need to remember not to take it for granted as well. Because even if you go to the north of Scotland, you struggle to find knitwear. Yeah. It's all more woven. Shetland is really special in that kind of aspect as well.
And I suppose there's so much happening today in terms of knitwear in Shetland. And I mean, it's fantastic, like having like yourself, that's quite a young voice in knitwear, that's kind of promoting it, and you really are promoting it to a worldwide audience. It's not the kind of insular cottage tradition that maybe it might have once been perceived as. It's kind of it's gone global, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. If you are a knitter and you're interested in using colour in your knitting, then you've heard of Fair Isle, which is amazing considering the size of Fair Isle, or the size
tiny,
of Shetland.
Tiny island.
It's crazy. And a lot of people as well, until they start looking more into it, they've heard of Fair Isle knitting, but they don't know that Fair Isle is a place. So
yeah,
it's crazy now that the knitting aspect of that island it's just so well known now, which is it's so encouraging to see. I think there's so much more that we could do. We've got knitters on board now, but I think there's so much more we could do with just people who are buying clothes. I think there's so much more information that we can get out there around knitting and wool and Shetland wool as well.
And that's actually something that you've been working on. You've done quite a lot of research on the benefits of wool, and you had a really, really interesting research project, and you've shared so much information about the benefits of wool. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how that came about?
Yeah, so it's something that I've always wanted to do, because there's so many things, so many facts about wool that I really think should be common knowledge, and it's things that we could definitely use more to our advantage than we do so far. When you're shopping for things like, you know, mattresses or carpets and things, then wool is an option there, but it doesn't straight away come to mind the reasons why you might choose wool. So I really wanted to get some of this practical information out into the world in a really attractive way. So I took on my friend Julie Dennison, who is an illustrator here in Shetland as well. She is the same age as me too. So I really wanted to work together and put this out together and kind of share all of this information. So I did the research, and then I invited her over to speak about this, and she just straight away started sketching, and I knew that she'd got my vision for the whole project straight away. I just love what she's produced. There's nothing I would change about it at all. When she came with all the pictures, I was just so impressed. So what we put together is initially just tiles of 12 different points of why a wool is beneficial for all different reasons.
Yeah.
And then we put them on a poster, and we sell the print now on my website too. And then we also turned it into practical products like cups and towels and coasters that are on the shop too, so that we can try and make these things that can be given as gifts, but are also informational as well. Yeah, so there's products on the shop website, and me and Julie are still working together on getting some more bits and pieces, so stay tuned for that too.
Brilliant. And I'll put a link to the shop in the show notes as well, so anybody that wants to go and have a look can go and find those. What are a couple of the benefits of wool that people might not be aware of?
Yes, I've got a few here that I really wanted to show you, so I'm so glad you asked. So first of all, something that maybe we don't think about straight away, but I feel like we should, is the wool that the sheep grows. We've seen it maybe being caught on fences, or some parts will fall off when we're coming to clipping time. And we don't classify that as, you know, litter or mess or anything. It's all natural. So we need to remember as well that even after something has been made into a garment.
That's an amazing analogy actually to think about, is, I mean, you're so right. When we look at the wool that we see in the hill, what we call hindelagets, we would never ever think on that as litter, because it biodegrades. And I was actually listening to someone the other day who said that she used fleeces to protect her apple trees, because all the nutrients went back into it and everything degraded back into the soil. So that's a really nice way to think on it. I'd never really considered it in that way before.
Well, exactly. I think a lot of the time when we see something being made into, like, clothes or anything, then we forget that it is 100% a natural product still. So we need to remember that we can take this natural materials and wear it, and it's still not wastage even when we're finished with it. Like you said, there's a lot of people that they'll take scraps from the clipping season and they'll put it in their vegetable plots and it fertilizes there. So they're so, we don't need to worry about disposing of these things after we're finished. They do last a long time. But even when we do, if it does return to the soil or it goes wherever, it only takes 3 to 4 months and then it's gone.
That's incredible. And
it is incredible. Another thing is that if we have wool on some of our interior products, like I said, couches or mattresses or carpets, the wool actually helps keep the air cleaner for up to 30 years.
Wow.
I know. And why is this not common knowledge? So what it does is the pollutants are picked up by the wool. And because it's an active fiber, we know that when the wool is on the sheep, that it's helping keep the sheep clean and things like that. It takes in those pollutants in the same way and it breaks them down. So it doesn't release them ever. It completely breaks them down so that they're no longer harmful. And it keeps your home cleaner for up to 30 years. It can do that.
That's amazing. And actually, I can totally vouch for it because my husband recently bought a 100% wool duvet. And I was quite skeptical because when it arrived, like I said to him, I said, it smells like an old yow. So it smelled like sheep. So that's just the lanolin, I suppose. But after a few days, then it no longer smelled like a sheep. But it's far better. The bed feels far more breathable. And it's incredible. Yeah. It's amazing how warm it keeps you when it's cold. But also it helps keep you cool in the summer, which is something that you don't get with a synthetic fibre.
Exactly, yeah. So the same way that it looks after the sheep in that way, it's not going to, like, any, I don't know, sweat that you give off during the night or anything, it's going to take that in and break it down as well. So it's not harmful anyway. It doesn't cling to you. It's got that layer that the outside fibers are kind of sitting on you, but the whole weight of the blanket won't be on you all of the time. So you'll still get that breathability. There's just so many plus points. There's some more as well for interiors as well. You want to be aware of any kind of fire risks, and that can be a real problem for synthetic materials.
Yeah.
But wool, it discourages flames from spreading and it burns really slowly. So wool can catch fire. It has to be, let me find that number of how hot things need to be for wool to ignite, because it's actually really surprising. But another thing with if there's a fire on the wool material is that it doesn't melt, drip or stick. So even after it's been on fire and the fire's gone out, it doesn't hurt you because it's not got that, you know, that drippiness that can be really harmful after the fact.
And I suppose it doesn't let off the same toxins that you might get if you're burning plastic or synthetics as well.
Exactly, it's all natural material, the whole 100%. I've got this number for you. It is, in order for wool to ignite, the temperature must be 570 to 600 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
So it's unimaginable.
Yeah, that's incredible.
It can go on fire, but it just doesn't hold it very well and it doesn't spread very well as well. So that's another plus point for having it in your interiors.
Yeah.
Also then we've got the water resistant quality, if you're wearing wool and it rains, then first of all, the first layer of your garment helps the rain kind of bead up and slip off.
Yeah.
If it's really heavy rain and it gets into the middle part of the wool, it will get wet, but it can absorb it really well. And that layer of fibers that are closest to you as well keeps that wet fabric off of you, so it doesn't drape on you. You're not getting that soaking wet feeling.
Yeah.
And also your body heat, kind of when the water is absorbed by the wool, it warms it up, so you're still warm while wearing that wet garment too.
So I suppose that's why a lot of fishermen traditionally would wear woolly ganzes, woolly jumpers, because they have such good qualities for keeping you warm and dry.
Yeah, so exactly. Fishermen and crofters as well. It's a favourite for both. Yeah. And my favourite reason is that you're directly supporting crofting and farming families. So the more demand there is for wool, the price will go up, and year by year, you will be supporting them straight away.
Yeah, and that's actually a really, really good point, because, I mean, in the past in Shetland, and not even the distant past, just maybe 30 or 40 years ago, I suppose, that you would quite often see fleeces by the side of the road, because when they were sheared, there was no market for them. But the knitwear industry has kind of grown again, and people are, I suppose, rediscovering natural fibres, and so that helps the farmers who are producing it, and it's helping the people who are producing garments, and it's kind of coming full circle again as we go back to what we were using in the past.
It really is, yeah, because the price of wool for the crofter, what they get changes year by year depending on demand. So if we can increase demand, the price changes straight away. So it really is a really good thing to do, especially if you have a local area that produces wool. You can know that you're supporting local families right away. Or if you have an area that you would like to support, then you know if you buy from that area, you're supporting the people in that area, which is, it's just a really good thing to do. And yeah, like you said, there's often been wastage.
Mm-hmm.
People would spend time burning the wool just to get rid of it because it wasn't worth taking to be sold, which is such a shame. And we're so glad that the knitting industry has grown, but also felting and spinning and dyeing as well.
Yeah.
The whole craft industry has just exploded really with this interest in wool, and it's so encouraging to see.
And it does, and it goes right back to helping the crofters or the farmers that are producing it. And there's time and time again, I always get asked when I have visitors here, and they're always fascinated by sheep and by the kind of process of taking the wool from the sheep. And I'm always asked, firstly, why do you shear sheep? And secondly, does it hurt the sheep? So can you talk us through that just quickly?
Yeah, so sheep, it definitely needs to be done once a year. Sheep need their wool taken off so that they can be comfortable during the summer. If they've got too much wool, then it restricts their mobility, so they can't, you know, jump over the ditch or, you know, go through the small gates or, you know, be comfortable with how they sit. So they need that taken off. It's also good for keeping them clean. So if you leave the wool on, they're more likely to get infections and things like that if they don't get that removed. The clipping process, it's so good for so many reasons. So first of all, the wool that is coming off of the sheep, it needs to be sold to help support that croft. And in order to be sold, it needs to be taken off quite well. It's a skill to get the wool off, and you need to be really careful in the way that you do it to get the best price for that fleece.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in the crofter and farmer's best interest to do it well.
Yeah.
It's also a chance for the sheep. They get their full kind of check over. They check their feet at that time. They check, you know, their stomachs and their faces, and they just make sure that everything is fine. It's generally the time where they pick up on things that maybe they need, you know, different kinds of medicine or treatment for something. Then it's clipping season where that's picked up on, because you get a good look over the whole sheep.
Yeah, because generally they're just out in the hill and they're free to roam, and they might be miles and miles away from home in the middle of the hills somewhere. So
exactly,
it's
yeah,
a good stock take.
Yeah, and how it's done as well, you know, you need to put them in their positions, but it's also the sheep needs to be comfortable in order for them to stay still to get a really good clip on that sheep. So it's in the crofter's best interest that the sheep is always comfortable too. So clipping is really not something that anyone needs to worry about. It is. I also find, I've spoken to a lot of people since doing this project who are vegans and they're still undecided about wool. But I think the more that we can encourage wool and increase demand for wool, the better care people will be taking with their sheep. They're taking care anyway, because in Shetland here we are lucky that Shetland sheep is in Shetland wool is in quite high demand. But it will encourage more care to be taken if there is a higher demand.
Yeah, and I think on the point of whether or not wool is safe or acceptable for vegans, like if you look at a sheep, naturally, every year they will start to shed their wool anyway. And in the past, people would just pull the wool off and it would just come off in the hand.
Yeah.
So by shearing them, you're doing something mechanically, albeit, but you're doing something that is happening naturally, as sheep naturally shed that wool anyway to make them more comfortable.
Yeah, and they're often visibly more comfortable after it's been done as well.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I say, is that it is a completely natural process.
Yeah.
Like you said, it will often come off on its own, and there's loads of pictures of it with that in the museum, isn't there, of people ruining the
absolutely.
The sheep.
That does look quite brutal when people, what we call, roo the sheep, so you're pulling the wool off by hand. But it's when the wool is naturally kind of shedding anyway, and you're just, I suppose, giving it a helping hand and combing it out, really.
It is combing it out, yeah, and it's just the same as, you know, when you're brushing a child's hair, I suppose. That it's not their favourite activity of the day. But no. It's not hurting them.
No. So, Tari, what is it that you are working on at the moment?
Yeah, so we are getting ready for Wool Week at the moment. Even though there is no official in-person events like we would normally enjoy, we've got a lot going on online. So with my granny Wilma being the patron this year as well, we're trying to just do as much as possible and prepare as much as possible before the main event. And the annual's coming out soon too, so that's all very exciting.
That's
just
it.
Bits and
the
pieces
Wool
for
Week
that.
Annual.
Yes, the Wool Week annual with all the patterns from various designers that's involved with Wool Week. So it's all very exciting. I've got a few more learning resources on the way, because I've really just enjoyed speaking to people and finding out where kind of the gaps are, and what people maybe need more help with in colour work and the early kind of more basic ferile stages. And what else? Well, like I said, I've got a few more things coming out to do with the Amazing Benefits of Wool project with Julie.
Okay.
And a couple more colourways on the way as well, so you'll have to look out for them.
Okay, so you're as busy as ever.
Yeah, I always have a few things on the go at any given time.
And for people who had hoped to be here for Wool Week, or who are still maybe coming here for what would have been Wool Week, what have you kind of got in the pipeline? Is there anything that you'd like to share?
Yeah, well, I've got my online classes that I am planning to do. I haven't set the exact dates for those. I'm just waiting for finding out what else is happening that week before I stick a date on them. I have a few things that I'm doing online with my granny, so I think that'll be a lot of fun. I don't know what's worse for her, is practicing with me, practicing her interviews with me, or doing interviews with me. I don't know what would be. I think I'll have more fun doing them with her, but I don't know. I don't know how she's feeling about it.
I'm sure we'll all enjoy tuning into them.
I like, I get her pushed into a new comfort zone, you could say.
A new comfort zone, that's a really nice way of looking at it.
But yeah, I'm so excited just to see what questions people have for her as well, and to... I'm lucky that I get to be a part of that a little bit too. So that's really exciting.
Yeah. And I suppose another question that I have is, I'm always interested in people who have kind of established a business. And I know that lots and lots of people have a dream that they would love to start their own business.
Nice to be able to be a part of that kind of events. And it's all things that I was really nervous about at the beginning, because I wasn't sure really what I had to offer, but just getting myself there, getting myself in the door and just going for it, it's been so worth it. So I definitely say just pick up every opportunity that comes, even if you're nervous.
Yeah.
You can decide after that not to do it ever again, but at least you've done it.
And do something every day that scares you.
Well, exactly. Yes, exactly. And for me, I don't know if there's anything that I've done and then I've thought, oh, I'm never ever doing that again. Most things I've done again and again. So it's really a lot of fun with that side of things. The support and encouragement of the people around me has been huge. So like I said at the beginning, my family being able to support me in the early stages and giving me advice right at the beginning. And then I went to the craft fair here in Shetland, which is in November. So there's not a lot of tourists or visitors at that time of year. So it was really Shetland people that were giving me the support there.
Yeah.
And then once it grew out of Shetland, it just grew all over. It was just, you must have had that as well, Laurie.
Yeah, it's just, for me, starting the business, the same as you, it's taken me down roads that I never imagined I would go down, and it's opened up doors that I never thought would be opened. And the same as you, my mantra is just say yes, kind of try everything. And if you don't enjoy it, then you don't have to do it again, but just keep going and keep putting yourself out there. And
definitely. So once the support grew out with Shetland, then it was just all over. So that's just been amazing. And it's just continuous as well. People don't get bored of supporting you. So just use the encouragement and do as much as you can. And then the final thing is just to remember to keep speaking to people about what you do. Just people that you see and then they ask what you do, just give them that extra little bit more detail, because those people are usually the people who have suggested me to try these different opportunities or have put me forward, or like you inviting me to do this with you today. It's all just come from speaking to the people you see every day about what you do, and they will sign you up for things.
You're really good at speaking to people and letting them know what you do. I've always admired what you do on social media, because you always come on and you speak to the people who are following you and you tell us what you're doing and what you're working on. And it's just fantastic to see a kind of behind the scenes look into someone's business, which we normally wouldn't see. And I don't know if I'm nosy, but I certainly enjoy that. And I enjoy feeling, I suppose in a way you feel like you're part of the process and part of the journey as well. And you're being taken along, and it's really interesting to see that.
Good. That's really what I was going for. I really like the idea of being approachable. Is a really big thing for me. It's kind of a value, maybe, that I really like being somebody that's approachable. So I wanted to gradually let people get to know me, and a byproduct of that has been people knowing which projects I'm going to be interested in and offering to get me involved. So I think that's a really good thing, is to use your own personality, because it can be so easy to go on social media and put on a personality that you think people want to see as well. That can be, it's almost second nature to do that, because you start to, do you know what I mean? It's something that you nearly try to switch on and off. But it's so much easier if you can just be yourself and let people honestly know what you're doing, and they will be interested, and they are interested to get to know you and get to know what you're interested in too. So
I think that openness and that honesty and just being yourself, I think that really does shine through. And you can always tell someone who, like yourself, that's just genuine and just genuinely loves what they do and loves sharing it with other people. And I suppose it's contagious, that kind of that energy.
When I think back to this
times that I've gone online, I think that I just go on and go, oh, today I'm excited about this. And then the next day, oh, today I'm excited about this. I use the word excited so much. So you have to laugh at things like that and just go for it.
Yeah,
people are enjoying it.
But then how awful would it be if we went onto your stories every day and all you did was moan?
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah.
There's that.
So where can people find you online? How can people get connected with you online? How will they find you?
Yeah, so there's a few ways. You can follow me on Instagram is usually my favourite place to be. You can also follow me on Facebook. All of my Instagram posts I post on Facebook as well. I have a newsletter and blog post that goes out every month, and that's from my website. So that's terrylaura.co.uk/blog. You can find those. And the website as well, I update now and again with whatever's going on. There's different sign up sheets for different topics. So if you're interested in taking an online class, you can sign up to be notified when the dates go out for those. Just have a good explore on the website and feel free to email me with any questions or anything that you would like more information on, because like I said, I like being approachable.
And I'll put all the information and all the links to your websites and social media in the show notes, but and it's Instagram and Facebook, that's at Terry Laura, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
And one last and final question. For visitors who are coming to Shetland, what would your top three recommendations be?
So you told me about this question before.
Yeah.
So I have had a bit of a thought to think about it. My overarching theme of all three points is just don't rush around doing things. Take your time when you're doing things.
Yeah.
So my first one is spend a lot of time on beaches and right near the sea, because it's good for you and it's not like anywhere else is what I came up with there.
Yeah.
So just spend a long time exploring a beach. You'll benefit from it so much.
And you can find so many interesting things on the beach.
Yeah.
If you look.
Exactly, yeah. Try as much local food as possible, because I think we're so lucky that we've got so many different food producers.
Yes.
That definitely if you're going into like smaller local shops rather than supermarkets, and you'll find different food producers, all from Shetland, and there's just so much good stuff to find. And finally, try and what I want to say is go and speak to the locals as well, because there's a lot of interesting people here with a lot of interesting stories, and I think sometimes they might be shy to begin with, but if you can get speaking to them, then there's so much to learn. I was also going to say that booking a tour guide is a good way to make sure that you are going to get a lot of information, because the tour guides here, you've all had to study things, study different areas in Shetland. There's so much work that goes into being a tour guide here. It's actually on my bucket list to hire a tour guide for Shetland. So
I'll give you a tour in exchange for the podcast interview.
Deal. Perfect. That'll be something to tick off for me.
You might want a different tour guide though.
Oh no.
that's really good suggestions though, because especially talking to local people, because local people here are so friendly, they really are, and they might not approach you, because sometimes we can be quite shy and quite not standoffish, but there is a kind of shyness.
There's kind of a feeling of not wanting to bother people too much.
Yeah.
But then so many people in Shetland have got just so much to tell, and I think life in Shetland can be really different compared to other places. So we kind of almost take it for granted that our lifestyle isn't the norm.
We do. And that kind of reminds me of last week my dad came along, and he was saying that some visitors had been staying in a little holiday cottage near where he keeps his boat, and they'd come out to look at what he at the catch that he'd taken ashore. So he has a small inshore boat and he fishes for the mackerel at this time of year, and so he offered them a what he called a fry of mackerel, which is just like a portion of mackerel, I suppose, to feed a family or whatever. And and they were really touched that he'd given away this fish, and he was trying to explain to them that, like, here in Shetland, that's just something that you do, is that you would give your fish to your neighbours and friends. And
it's a
really friendly community, and there is still that good sense of community here.
Definitely. If you find that people are shy as well, it's just they are going to be really generous with their time once they start speaking, and generous with everything else too. So that's such a good example of, just approach people and ask them what they're up to today.
Well, thank you very much. That's been a really good chat that we've had. Is there anything else that you would like to kind of add or say, or have I exhausted you?
I think we've covered a lot.
But I think we'll have to get you back on to do more.
Oh, Laurie, if you need a co-host, sign me up.
I will.
I'll be back.
But listen, thank you so much. And I will put all the links in the show notes and everything. And just encourage everybody to go and find you on Instagram at Terry Laura. And hopefully we will all be looking out for the various classes and things that you're offering for what would have been Wool Week.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Laurie. I've had such a good time with you, and I will definitely be back. I'll be pestering you.
Oh, thank you again, and take care, and we will speak to you soon. Thank you for listening. This podcast can only be made possible by my supporters on Patreon, so a huge thank you to all my patrons. If you would like to support me in bringing you more of these shows, you can sign up and become a patron. You will find details about how to sign up in the show notes below, or at www.patreon.com, and just search Shetland with Laurie. And remember, you can find more on Instagram and give me a follow at Shetland with Laurie. So thank you once again for listening, and we will see you here next time. And in the meantime, safe and happy travels.